Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with Jewish Journal publisher and editor-in-chief, David Suisa. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I could continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details pinned in the comments below. So today is Purim. Another Jewish holiday with the common theme, they tried to kill us, we destroyed them, let's eat. It seems most Jewish holidays follow the same storyline. And though it's easy to make light of it, ultimately, there's nothing light about the plight of anti-Semitism that has plagued the Jews ever since, well, ever since there's been a Jew. You can call it a prophecy. All throughout the Torah and the Talmud, it's asserted that the Jewish nation will always have enemies who seek to annihilate us, and that they will never succeed. They never do. There have been periods in history when the Jewish people marched submissively to our own slaughter. But with the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, we decided never again. Hamas's 10/7 orgy of terror challenged that affirmation. And in the face of existential threat, Israel has fought back hard. For 17 months, Israel has simultaneously fought terrorists on seven fronts, and the Jewish people have been fighting viral anti-Semitism that has consumed the West like a cancer. Even as the military war has been in ceasefire for 2 months, unprecedented levels of anti-Semitism continue to mount and boil over across the globe. The entire Jewish world has been struggling to defuse this ticking time bomb, and David Suisa has an entirely new proposal. Today, David and I will discuss his recent op-ed, Fighting Anti-Semitism by Loving America. We'll discuss the challenges of modern anti-Semitism and how proud American Jews can positively rebrand for a brighter and more tolerant future. By means of introduction, David Suisa is the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Jewish Journal, the largest Jewish weekly in the country. For the past 17 years, David has been writing a weekly column in the journal that earned him the Best Columnist Award by the LA Press Club and first prize for editorial writing by the American Jewish Press Association. Prior to journalism, David was the founder and CEO of Suisa Miller Advertising, a marketing firm that was named Agency of the Year by USA Today. In 2005, he sold the company so he could dedicate himself full time to the Jewish world. David was born in Morocco and grew up in Montreal, where he graduated from McGill University in 1978. He now lives with what I can personally attest is his very beautiful family in a Jewish neighborhood of Los Angeles. That reminds him a little of his old neighborhood in Casablanca. David, as always, it's such a pleasure to see you, and it's an honor to have you on the show.
It's great to be here, Shauna. Thanks.
Thank you. So when I met you right around the turn of the century, you were the CEO of Suisa Miller. Even then, you were deep in the effort to rebrand Judaism. You were self-funding a magazine, an artistic masterpiece of words and pictures and mysticism called Olam, which aimed to bring all Jews of all backgrounds back together under one shared tent. I happen to have one of the, it doesn't turn out well with the background. One of the magazines here. I'm not sure if you remember this one, but this one was particularly interesting because there's actually an article by Michael Jackson in here, just showing how big the tent was. And it was a series of beautiful artwork and poetry, articles, opinion pieces, and all in all, a beautiful paean to the Jewish people. Now, in addition to this, you also brought in rabbis on Fridays for talks that anyone in your agency could attend, and sometimes total randos like me. I'd love to know. You were already doing so much for the Jewish people, David, and you were at the top of the advertising game. What compelled you to leave the agency that you founded and built into such a powerhouse and dive headfirst into full-time Jewish advocacy?
You know, I think it's common in many lives. As you get older, you get in your 40s especially, you start thinking, is what I'm doing in life meaningful enough? Is it giving me enough meaning? Because at some point, you make enough money so that meaning becomes a much bigger, plays a much bigger role in your life. And you know, you may be raising kids, have great friends, have a great life, but you always want something deeper. And at the time, you know, Israel was under a lot of pressure. There was the Second Intifada. There was suicide bombs going off like crazy. I had met this mystical rabbi called Manis Friedman. So a lot of things were changing in my own life. And I decided that I wanted to go deeper. So it happened in both fronts. I can't, you took me down memory lane now with Olam magazine. So for a few years, you know, we did this spiritual magazine, and I was using all the talent that God gave me for advertising in terms of, you know, shining the diamond of a product, whether it's Acura or what have you. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be kind of cool if we could shine the rough diamond of Judaism, just like we're shining the rough diamond of all our other clients, right? So that's what led to Olam magazine. And then after 2 years of Olam, the Second Intifada hit, and then it's like, oh my God, you know, Israel needs my help. So one thing led to another. We had a great offer, and I sold a company. I had to stay on for a little longer, and I kind of transitioned not just to the Jewish people, but also to my first love, which was journalism.
Yeah, it's been amazing. And in case I didn't make a strong enough case for it, David self-funded this magazine and even put it in the LA Times Sunday edition as an insert. No advertising, even though he's an ad guy. So let's talk about your recent Jewish Journal column, entitled Fighting Anti-Semitism by Loving America. Or as it appears in the URL, if you hate Jews, you hate America. A thought-provoking and strategic shift in the American fight against anti-Semitism as you look for new solutions to the world's oldest hatred. To set the stage for today's discussion, how first, would you describe the nature of anti-Semitism today? And we're going to focus today on America specifically, and who are the perpetrators?
You know, like you said in your intro, it's the world's oldest hatred. My friend Gil Troy calls it the plastic hatred. It adapts constantly through the centuries to whatever it needs to be. Whatever is the worst in the world is kind of, you know, put on the Jews. So we become the world's favorite scapegoat. Whatever I hate about the world, I now associate with Jews. So it's created this amorphous, constantly changing thing. And the only thing that never changes, there's always a good reason to hate Jews. So the most recent one has been using Israel, the Jewish state. And we've seen that tremendously, especially since the war in Gaza. So there's been this debate, you know, anti-Zionism, is that the same thing as anti-Zionism? So the anti-Semitism from the right is still there. The anti-Semitism from the left has come up big time. And now it's this big, big mess of Jew hatred. And we're at a time in America when Jews are also associated with some bad stuff. For example, white privilege. It's not a good thing these days, right? We've redefined success as white privilege. And Jews, for rightly or wrongly, are perceived as the ultimate in white privilege, right? So a lot of factors are conspiring to make this a very tough situation for Jews.
And I like your choice of the word conspiring because this is where, for me, the challenge comes in. With social media and conspiracy theories being so prevalent, that when we have an actual and timeless conspiracy, people write it off as little more than another conspiracy theory. People do not want to accept that Jew hatred is truly an age-old conspiracy that has followed us through millennia. So we have this, I'm going to call it the new anti-Semitism, because I'd say classical anti-Semitism would be like the neo-Nazi, right-wing, far nationalist anti-Semitism. And this new anti-Semitism has basically become like a fixture of society. Pathetically, it's been normalized, completely unapologetic, and sadly, even socially acceptable. We have these neo-progressive anti-Semites on the left that are driving the vast predominance of the hate we see all over the news today, the neo-Nazi anti-Semites on the right, and a bunch in the middle who just got caught holding the hot potato latke without any real agenda. It's just a blind hatred they don't even understand. So now that we've sort of defined our very motley target audience, can you explain the strategy that you lay out in your column to shift this disturbing and deeply anti-Semitic narrative about the Jewish people?
Okay, a little background. It's human nature to follow patterns. It's not human nature to identify a break in the pattern. So, if we have a pattern for 19 centuries, it's very difficult to imagine that the pattern may be broken, right? My friend Micah Goodman said in 2,000 years, the Jews had two great dreams. And both of those dreams came true in the same century. The first dream was the dream to come home to Zion, to return to Israel. And for 19 centuries, your ancestors and mine, three times a day, prayed that they would eventually return home to Zion. And you and I are born in the generation to return home. That was the first great dream. And then the second great dream was to encounter a country, a people, a nation that would welcome us as legal equals, right? And that dream was America. So those two great dreams came true. So I was born in Casablanca. And for me, as much as I'm attached to the culture of Morocco, it was so far from America. I was sitting with these two Jewish giants the other night at a dinner. I won't name them, but they're giants. One of them is a giant of comedy, and the other one was a giant of literature, right? And I sat there at one point because they were talking about anti-Semitism, and I'm saying, I don't know what it is to grow up with Jewish cultural heroes. I grew up in Casablanca, you know. Our dream was to be able to do Shabbat and everybody to leave us alone. The thought that I would put on the TV in Casablanca and see Jewish cultural heroes making all of Morocco laugh, and all of Morocco read the same novel, and all of Morocco see the same TV show like Seinfeld and so forth, that's a fantasy for me. So what you guys take for granted, I don't. So when I came to America, and I saw the incredible infiltration and integration of Jews in American culture, it kind of blew me away. And the more I got into it and I learned about the Jewish lawyers in the 60s who would hitchhike to Mississippi to fight for the rights of blacks and their civil rights, and everything from Saul Bellow and Philip Roth and the great, great comedians and the great builders and the scientists. It just dawned on me that there's something special that happened in this country, America, between the Jews and America. And I think we were so grateful to finally meet this country that took us in as equals, notwithstanding all the anti-Semitism that is still there, right? That there was still this incredible love affair, this mutual love affair. You know, I would go to Billy Crystal's show on Beverly Hills, like 300 Sundays, whatever it was. You know, there's like, I don't know, thousands of people. And all of them, they look like non-Jews, right? And they're watching 3 hours of Jewish humor, right? I watched Larry David, and I'm thinking there are millions of non-Jews watching this Jew make fun of a rabbi, and he kind of looks cool. He doesn't take himself too seriously. And all this stuff that so many Ashkenazi Jews in America take for granted, I don't. I don't. When I read that the second language in Hollywood is Yiddish, right? I don't take that for granted. So there is a kind of a cultural connection between Jews and America. And if you peel the onion and go deeper, you realize that the founders of America, they read the Old Testament.
Right.
It's so based on Judeo-Christian values, right? George Washington, you know, wrote letters connecting the birth of America with the end of slavery from Exodus. And there's so many instances of the bond between Jewish values, Jewish biblical values, and the birth of America. So over the past few decades, I've unfolded and learned more and more and more about how the bond between the Jews and America. So now, because of my background in advertising, I have a tendency to look at branding, right? So I'm looking at the Jewish brand and what's been happening to the Jewish brand in the past few years, especially since October 7th, right? So we've been really, really fighting back. And I'm like you, I'm one of the fighters. I fight against anti-Semitism, but I also ask myself the question, what's the best way to fight? And I think there is a tendency to fight without realizing what are the unintended consequences. So we may be doing something that is absolutely correct and true and appropriate, but it doesn't mean that it's going to work. Because if the image right now of Jews, because we have invested hundreds of millions of dollars on the fight against Jew hatred, is that we are now a people that are really worried, we're scared, and we're fighting for security, and we need more money to protect our synagogues. And every time there's another instance of anti-Semitism, we constantly call it out and condemn it. And there is a risk when you do that, that the brand, the Jewish brand, becomes diminished, and we become known as a people that is hated, and as a people that cares only about itself. So I've written several columns. You mentioned one of them. And I think we cannot forget the bigger picture. The bigger picture is that we're not a hated people in America. Although our haters would like that to be true, the bigger picture, if you look at the research from Pew, year after year, believe it or not, we're the most admired, favorite religious group in America. We're like number one, not by a lot, but we're consistently ranked as the most admired group. Now, you know, we're not going to do very well when victimhood becomes the heroes, when victims become the heroes, because we just don't make great victims for whatever reason. It's kind of the price we have to pay for our success is that we don't have that much credibility when we try to convince America that we're really victims, even when we are, even when we're unfairly assaulted on college campuses and so forth. So what I've tried to bring out in my Jewish Journal column in the last few months, and there are several columns. There's one this week called, you know, on not being afraid of good news. That's my latest one. And there's one before that that I think the one after the one on America, but they have the same theme that we need to start fighting like winners and not whiners. And sometimes we invest so much money in the fight. And look, I'm an activist. I know what activism is. I mean, I'm a journalist, but I used to be more of an activist. And I'm surrounded by activism. And the best way to raise money is to focus on trouble. That's how you raise money. Good news does not raise money. So there is a bias. And as a journalist, I know that I can get more readers if I put anti-Semitism in my headlines, if I put trouble in my headlines. I'm aware of those biases, but I'm also aware that we're under siege and we want to win. And what I'm trying to add to the conversation is let's expand our definition of winning.
Yeah, and the truth is, David, I actually personally have tremendous hope in your theory. The problem is, I have deep despair about the state of the world. Like you, I've actually personally advocated for years, and particularly within the Jewish diplomatic corps that I'm a part of, to focus on the Jewish people's positive contributions to society instead of wasting our time and energy defending ourselves in this kangaroo court of relentless and ridiculous accusations. And I definitely agree that "we don't suck" is not a winning campaign. But
Right.
this is a unique hatred and a very unique time. And the problem is that even when we discuss shared values, the resounding response has been loud, tone deaf, and vicious. Like, the most violent comments I get online, and I get them all day, are the ones in response to content expressing shared Jewish and American morals and values. It's
Right.
like to a wall. So,
Right. I think you're missing one thing.
yeah.
You're missing one thing. A lot of my motivation is to crush the enemy. It's
Yeah.
very important you understand that. There is nothing schmaltzy in my approach whatsoever. My goal is to crush the hater, to humiliate him, to diminish him, and to make the hater look like a loser. And it's really important you understand that I'm not coming from some schmaltzy place whatsoever. And I know that one of the ways that you crush a hater is to make him feel like he's losing. You know, the expression manifest, it's been so popular, like in the last couple of years. I look at, the self-help industry, and you want to meet your soulmate, and you want to reach a, you aspire to something in your life, right? And I've heard that expression so often. You kind of manifest it, right? And I think the Jewish community, they've kind of missed this one point on the act of manifesting something that they'd like to see. What I'd like to manifest is that the Jew haters in America, whether they're the ones that are going in total hysterics on the Columbia College campuses in UCLA, or whether they're the ones coming at us, as pro-Hamas on the streets or at the United Nations and everything, that they I want them to feel like they're really losing. And I want them to feel like their goal of turning us into losers, of crushing us, is failing. That we are actually winning. Their biggest nightmare is that we're winning. What I'd like to do is to manifest the nightmare of the Jew haters. And I actually use that language.
Yeah.
When I'm on
Yeah.
Twitter, I remind them how much they're losing and how much we're winning. Do you want to know my daughter at NYU? She was literally, she was just complaining about all the stuff that was going on. Everybody's wearing keffiyehs and everything. And, they're just spending all their days hating Israel. They're not going to classes, they're not doing their exams. And you know how she ended up winning? In her case, she got straight A's. She didn't miss one of her classes. She was really a strong, happy Jew. So I'm not saying we don't fight. What I'm saying is we should make the noise. The noise we make should be on the winning part of the Jews. But in terms of how we fight, I'm a huge proponent of using the courts, right? Legal fights.
So let me ask then, David, because I think this is where I'm a little unclear is like, so who is the audience? Because I think that the problem today is that we are all entrenched so deeply in our own echo chambers that the only people who will listen are the people who already agree. So when you say that we should be focusing on our shared like Jewish positive American values, and I want to focus today more on that first article about the Americanism, who is the audience for that message exactly?
I have to tell you, like even in my own audience, a lot of them don't agree with me
Right.
because they're not used to hearing this. So last thing I'm doing is preaching to the choir, whether it's inside the Jewish community or outside. But my goal is the general American population, when they get on social media, when they get on mainstream media, whatever media they have, there's a general Jewish brand that comes across. And right now that Jewish brand is looking weak. We're looking under siege because the number one thing they hear about Jews right now is that we're complaining, we're afraid, people are hating us, and we need protection. And what I'm trying to add to the conversation is let's expand that brand, that that's not all that we are. We are a lot more than that. And one of those critical things that we are is that we love this country. It doesn't mean we have all the shared values. It just means we love this country. And in many ways, America loves us back. But the Jew haters hate that message. Whatever Jews haters hate, I love. And whatever Jew haters love, I hate. That's kind of a good starting point for me. It's
So,
just not the starting point for most activists.
let me ask you, David, really quickly, which do you think is more influential today, mass media or social media?
Social media, for sure. Social media, because it's just the new generation spends most of their times on social media. It's the way people consume news. It's the way they consume information. I'm deeply aware that everything we do needs to be able to be condensed in a short form. That's why I spent a lot of times working on headlines. So yeah, for sure, for sure. But the one thing that's also been happening, Shauna, is that so many of the messages feel repetitive, in so many ways. I mean, I will read 500 articles on anti-Semitism. And there's a sense of we're being told the same thing over and over and over again. And one of the things I learned in the ad business is the number one commandment, thou shalt not bore. I've never forgotten that one. Right? So we really, like when I write, it's kind of a little bit as my starting point. How can I write something that will, advance the conversation? And try to say something new, something fresh. And sometimes people are not used to hearing it. So they misinterpret it. Like they'll misinterpret as if I'm not willing to fight, as if I'm making a schmaltzy message. We say, you're just worrying about good news, and we're the real fighters here fighting the bad news. And I'm saying, no. I'm just into fighting as you guys are. I'm just trying to introduce maybe a new way to fight, a smarter way to fight that might become better, for us, for the Jews, and for the country. Now, Jew haters, in general, they do have a tendency to be anti-America. You see a lot of what you see now on college campuses, they go together. The anti-Israelism and the anti-Americanism, they kind of go hand in hand. And one of the things in terms of the public perception of the Jews is I want America to know, we're lovers of this great country. That we don't just care about ourselves. There was a great line that I grew up with in the ad business from Bill Birnbach. He was one of the great geniuses. And he would say, you know, we're so busy measuring public opinion that we forget we can mold it. Right? And I think in the Jewish world, we've become really good at measuring public opinion, and we're kind of measuring how bad it's getting. And I asked in my latest column, I said, you know, we've invested hundreds of millions of dollars fighting anti-Semitism. How come it keeps getting worse? If our fight was a business, we'd be in chapter 11 right now, right?
Right.
So I'm trying to ask those tough questions
Yeah.
from a
And
good place, from a good place.
it's very tough answers because, David, as you well know, modern day anti-Semitism unfortunately does not end at our doorstep. And if we look into our own backyards, at the, I'll just call it the enemy within, there are many, who will argue these days that the biggest threat to the Jewish future is not actually Hamas or Hezbollah or even the internet trolls or Iran, but rather our own fractured Jewish community. The Jews have turned against the Jews, and ironically, they all claim to be guided by Jewish values. So, for argument's sake, let's assume we already share Jewish values with the self-hating Jews. Then what? Like, so would shared American values entice these disaffected members of the tribe like back into the fold? I think that there's an inherent miscommunication, perhaps, or misunderstanding of not only what are Jewish values, but how are they manifesting in the world today?
You know, I try to look at battles that we can win rather than those we can't, right? So if there is a legal battle with the students who harass Jews at UCLA, and we can get a positive outcome by going with the law, by working with the authorities and win, I love those. I love battles where we can win. Now, to try to get a Jew hater to stop hating Jews, that is a battle I could never win. To try to get a Jew from
Yeah.
the left who constantly criticizes Zionism, who may be anti-Zionist, who uses Jewish values to bash their own group, who's
Right.
now fighting for the rights of the Palestinian from Colombia, who's been arrested, to try to get those Jews to change their mind, that's not a winning battle for me. Kind of almost a waste of time, and it doesn't totally bother me as much as it does other Jews, because I think so much of this ideological diversity is one of the things I love about us, is the fact that we do argue, is the fact that we do have so many different voices as opposed to one homogeneous voice, which is totally unrealistic. So that's another battle. But the other battle that we can win, right, is the fact that it's true that we love America. And if you convey that message, there's something else that I wrote about in the column that I learned in advertising, which is there's a difference between what you say and what you communicate. The victory is in what you communicate. So we could say, we need to stop the anti-Semitism against Jews. And we could invest $300 million in that statement that is utterly true. But what are we communicating? So we may be communicating that there's a lot of reasons to hate Jews. And what we're communicating is the exact opposite of what we want to communicate. So what I try to focus on is getting victories in the second part, right? Is I want to communicate that we're winners, we're winning. We love this country. The ones who hate us are the total losers. And you know what? Somebody that hates Shauna, they merit the label of being a loser, right? So that's what I want to communicate. And also, I want to communicate that when we fight, we win. So when we use the courts, the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, when we go on in the court system, in the legal system, when we speak to the deans of NYU and Columbia and we get positive outcomes. I love those victories, you should know. because it reinforces the idea that we win, that you don't mess with the Jews. And I think we invest so much of our energies and resources on screaming, on complaining, on condemning, on, forgive me if I'm going on a little bit longer, right? But I had a group of Jewish college students who were complaining about what they were seeing on campuses, right? All this hate and hate and hate that you and I have read about for so much for the past year and a half. And I said, you know what you guys should try one day? Do a pop-up, a Tel Aviv pop-up. Like we have great Tel Aviv techno music and start dancing and have a huge Israeli flag, have a huge American flag and kind of party. So they focus on hate and hate, hate, hate. We focus on dancing and having fun as opposed to trying to outscream the haters, which I think doesn't give us a victory.
So David, I'm gonna ask because so as my background photo, you see a US flag and an Israeli flag, and there's me in the middle. this way is a very typical Israel rally. Obviously you recognize that on veterans is in front of the what's it called building, the federal building on Wilshire. And anybody who sees any rally ever, the pro-Israel rallies are always American flag, Israeli flag calling for peace. Everybody can see with their own eyes that every rally against Israel is Palestinian flag, zero American flags unless it's being burnt, and calling for intifada. So the problem is that we don't even need the messaging. Our actions speak for themselves, but people still seem to be very morally confused at the difference between this rally and somebody with a mask and a Hezbollah or Hamas headband and screaming for death to all Jews, and that people are literally creating moral equivocations like this all day, every day.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. I really am, because I've been to many of those. And I love that you brought up the American flags are only on one side. But I come from the world of advertising where one word can make a huge difference. My world, right? So one of the things that's missing on the Jewish side is the word America, because we show both flags, but all the words have to do is with Israel. Israel, Israel, we stand with Israel. Israel wants peace. It's good, which is a good thing. But what's missing in terms of our messaging is just the idea of connecting Jews with America. It could be as simple as Jews for America. It could be as simple as Jews love America. So imagine that you're driving down Wilshire Boulevard, Shauna, and you don't really know much about the whole case. On one side, you have all Palestinian, Palestinian, anti-Israel, anti-Israel. And on the other side, you have Jews, America, Israel, Jews love America, God bless America. It's like, hello, which side feels more familiar? Which side feels more likable? Which side feels more like you'd want to take the side of, you know?
I agree with you, but that's my whole point. It's confounding
Right.
that people are still choosing the other side.
Right.
Any
Right. Right. But what I'm saying though is that we're missing the America part, that we're assuming that just the flag alone is enough. And I think our messaging needs to introduce the words America. We need to connect the word Jews with America. And that's not been done. And one of the reasons it hasn't been done, it's for good reason, because we're really worried about ourselves right now. So we're worried about ourselves. We're worried about Israel is under siege. Jews are under siege. So there's no room for America. I'm trying to make room for America.
Okay, well, These days, like, there's no way to decouple anti-Semitism from anti-Zionism, anti-Israel, anti, name the thing. So here's what I'd actually like to present is the case study of AIPAC, which both you and I have been, I'm still heavily engaged in. I assume you are too. I don't know. Since policy conference stopped, you don't know who's there and who's not there anymore. But for anyone who doesn't know, okay, AIPAC is the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee. You can't get any clearer about American and Israeli values being together in that one. It's a profoundly bipartisan organization, though so many people want to say that it's Republican. It isn't. It is so bipartisan and fundamentally bipartisan. AIPAC is the precise embodiment of shared US-Israeli values. And it goes beyond just the American and the Israeli flags. David, we sing Hatikva, yes, but we also sing the national anthem and we sing the national anthem first, always. But far from endearing the pro-Israel lobby and the Jews to the American people, AIPAC has instead been extensively and aggressively demonized and raked through the social media mud as being nothing more than a modern-day incarnation of the Elders of Zion. So I want to know how do you envision the execution of the Proud American Jew campaign in light of this particular phenomenon?
Great. I'm glad you brought it up. We used to have the 10-90 rule in advertising. It was 10% of the people make 90% of the noise. This is one thing we've seen recently is 90% of the noise will be on some horrible thing like you just mentioned. But they're not the majority. They're a minority that knows how to use social media to create this perception that they're a lot bigger than they really are. A lot of the work that AIPAC does, I think they're one of the most crucial organizations for the Jews, for America, and for Israel, because they focus on the relationship between America and Israel, right? It's not one or the other, it's both the relationship. A lot of the work they do, Shana, is behind the scenes. So when we see some incredible thing that's happening for the Jews, it could be in Congress or it's a great thing for Israel. They work behind the scenes. Now, I'm not behind the scenes at all. So they do great work behind the scenes. God knows where we would be without them, right? They do fantastic work behind the scenes. But us, we're in front. We're in front. And one of the things I feel obligated is to let all my readers know that this huge noise that you're hearing is done by a small minority of very, very loud people. We've seen this in the last year and a half with the college campuses, where it created this perception, what I call the oh my God perception. Oh my God, so you got like 30,000 Jewish students in this campus and that thing, and it really looks like hell if you're not there. And it turns out it's this small group who are really smart at making a lot of noise. Meanwhile, the large majorities don't hate the Jews. Their friends are Jews. They have no problem with Jews. They're probably on the side of Israel. So we have an obligation as reporters and as journalists to complete the picture. If all I do as a journalist is report the bad news, I am being irresponsible, because I am creating a distorted picture of reality. Because the reality is a lot broader than the bad news. So when I include the good news, I feel I'm being more responsible as a journalist.
I agree. And I want to hone in on your concept of one word, Right. So before you said like the one word that's missing is America, and that whenever you're coming up with a branding campaign, there's going to be that word that changes everything, right? So going back to your concept of by focusing on the negative aspects of anti-Semitism, that maybe people will see us as a nation only. I say nation. I refer to all Jews as a nation only worthy of hate. Now, when it comes to using one word, I do want to push back on this concept of stepping away from the anti-Semitism narrative, only because if so, seeing as anti-Semitism is this unfortunate, undeniable, and ubiquitous historical theme. And if exposing that hatred is actually branding us as detestables, or potentially as detestables, then my question is, what about Islamophobia? And what I mean by this is, so Islamists literally created the concept of Islamophobia and has strategically propagated this word and this theory as widely as possible, even where it may not even exist, specifically to shame and shut down critics and to manipulate minds into supporting them. And frighteningly enough, it's working really well. And as it turns out, today's Americans, though deathly allergic to hate, so they run from Islamophobia, somehow they're simultaneously willing to wholly embrace anti-Semitism, whatever the percentage of the people is. It's a much larger, the crimes against Jews, hate crimes, is exponentially larger than those against Muslims, if you just look at the actual statistics. So the deliberate weaponization of Islamophobia has proven to be such an extraordinarily successful strategy. So why do you feel, and I'm not saying you're wrong, I actually agree, but why do you feel that anti-Semitism awareness may be backfiring in contrast?
Because we don't make good victims, you know. Jews have a reputation in America of being successful. A lot of it is based on the truth. I think we need to open ourselves up to the possibility that the 19th century history of anti-Semitism took a little detour when we came to America. That it's quite possible that what we got used to for 19 centuries, which is they're going to hate us no matter what, right? Took a detour. That this is a brand new experience. That brand new experience does not mean that there is no anti-Semitism, but it does mean that it takes on a whole different context, a different texture, because we're free to fight it, we're free to express ourselves. We've never been this free. We've never had this amount of freedom to express ourselves culturally on so many levels, right? And I think we can't overlook that and condemn America to being just another one of those countries, whether it was Suiza in Morocco or your ancestors in wherever, Romania and Russia. I don't want to put America, I don't want to lump America as one of those countries where Jews got consistently hated from the time that Jesus died to the time of the Holocaust. I think America is on a whole other level. And I think part of our reaction to anti-Semitism is we don't want to lose our gratitude for this great country. And part of that is we have to just accept that at some point, there's going to be a group that have a political advantage in hating us, especially at a time when if you're not white, if you're weak, if you're powerless, that's going to give you a PR victory. And the Palestinians, have been the most brilliant victims in human history. This is what they do. They're weak, they're powerless, they're not white, and this is what they do. So they absolutely have won PR victories. Israel is so powerful. It's seen as a Western country at a time when the West has become an enemy. The West has become a bad thing, right? Western values. So we check off a lot of boxes, we being Israel, the Jews, and America. We come been lumped together. And I think we need to stay strong and to have faith in Western values. And despite the fact we're going through a rough patch right now in terms of those Western values, which is very synonymous with Israel values and American values and Jewish values, right? We're going through a rough patch. And I think we need to stay strong because during this rough patch, Islamophobia is going to become a big concern. And it's going to look like the Muslims are winning the PR battle. And you know what? I've learned as a former PR guy, sometimes there are certain PR battles that you just say, you know what? Let's contain it.
Yeah.
Let's minimize it. I have to share something terrible with you because I was watching a movie on Donald Trump. Right?
Okay.
The most divisive human being I have ever come across. Public or private, I'm telling you, we can do a 3-hour show on Donald. 3 hours, guaranteed, nonstop, you and I have never encountered a subject that has given me more of a challenge in terms of how to write about him. And I've written about him many, many ways, and I've constantly tried to add something new. I'm an independent. I feel I bring a lot more to my readers if I don't take sides, or if I can try to analyze. And he's absolutely a blowhard, and he's a power monger, and he's obsessed with making deals, and he's obsessed with getting ripped off, and blah blah blah. But I bumped into a movie last night. I was with my mother, and we're watching this movie. It's called The Apprentice, and I think that it's the guy from Succession, Jeremy Strong, who played the Khan. There was this famous Jewish lawyer in the 60s and 70s. Forget the first name. Tough guy, and I knew about him. There was a moment in the film, Shauna, that I never forgot. Because this is the tough mafia lawyer, Jewish guy, who taught Trump everything he knows and who made Trump very successful in the real estate jungle of Manhattan. And he said to him, "You always win no matter what. You always declare victory no matter what. Always." And it stuck with Donald 50 plus years ago. And I was thinking of his victory in the last election. And I kept looking at him as he was in court month after month. And he kept coming out of court. And I'm saying, I hate lawsuits. Keep me out of a courthouse. And I'm saying, this guy, he's been under indictment. He's under like 4 or 5 major lawsuits. He's gone from one courthouse to another. At no point did he ever look like a loser. And why am I bringing this point up? It's the idea of manifesting ourselves, the Jews. Manifesting the Jews. We don't want to look weak. We don't want to look like we're losing. And I think so often we fight so much against the anti-Semitism and we complain so much. And it's all true, by the way. It's all justified that we forget that there's this bigger picture where we will be a lot more successful if we keep that idea in mind that we don't want to look like losers. We want to, yes, when we fight, we always win, whether it's a case in Colombia or a case in what have you. If you go after the Jews, there's going to be consequences. We win. And when, we also fight by being the winners. And, at the end of the day, America does like winners. And I'm not saying we should do this just to be loved. I'm not saying we should do this to be liked by America. I'm saying we should also do this for ourselves. We have a new Jewish generation that are under siege. They're feeling insecure. They need also this kind of gene of, you said something fantastic in your opening. You said, and they never succeed, the haters. We need to teach the Jewish generation, we're not perfect. We make mistakes. But there's a lot about Judaism and your Jewish tradition and your Jewish history that you should be proud of.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that the problem is that when there are billions of people who are threatening us online, there's very few of us who are willing to speak up to that or to take that kind of abuse. So many people step down and out of the conversation because it for them just emotionally it's just not worth it. You have to you and I have been in this for decades, so we develop a pretty thick skin after a while. But for those who have just jumped into the fray in the most contentious moment in Israeli history, it's not an easy conversation for people to have, and so we wind up being drowned out. But before we move forward, I want to go back a few minutes to when you said that we don't make good victims, because I agree. I mean, we've been successful well beyond our numbers, and we could get into the white privilege issue in a moment, but here's, I guess, what's disturbing about this concept of good victims. Because the implication being that the Hamas terrorists that invaded the kibbutzim and the Nova Festival and did unspeakable atrocities are considered good victims. And I think that if you want to say, as a broader Jewish world, we're not good victims because of how many Nobel Prizes we win and how wealthy we've become and how successful we've been in all the things. In this day and time, we're in for the first time, like we're seeing this explosion of anti-Semitism as a direct response to Jews being victimized on 10/7. This didn't wait for the war. This happened on 10/7,
Oh, yeah.
right? And
Oh, yeah.
so when the good victims are rabid, monstrous, diabolical terrorists, where, like, how can I just how can we even reconcile any argument with that kind of moral depravity? I mean, people are calling it moral confusion. It is, but it stems from actual depravity.
Let's try to unpack that.
Yeah.
It's a crucial point you made, because there was a 7 day period after the nightmare of October 7th. So many of my friends who were not that connected with Israel or with Judaism, they've told me over and over again, it was that first week that influenced them the most. I said, why? Because they said Israel had not gone into Gaza. Israel had not killed one Palestinian. Done nothing yet. And yet they saw groups on college campuses. My God, if not now, Jewish Voices for Peace. They started seeing the movement against Israel after 1,200 Israelis got massacred and 250 got, taken hostage. And they said that never left me. To this day, it never left them. Because there was absolutely no excuse whatsoever not to take the Israeli side at that point, or at least to shut up. But the fact that the instant, the reflex is so anti-Israeli and so anti-Jewish that they immediately jump to blaming Israel for the massacre of October 7th. What did you expect after the occupation? This is the resistance and so forth. So that's the first point I want to make to unpack what you brought up. The second point regarding victims is the more accurate word is credible. We don't make credible victims. And I think part of the reasons we don't make credible victims is a kind of a compliment to the Jews, because we have worked so hard not to be victims that it's kind of a compliment because we're not seen as credible victims. Now, the fact that we have become victims after the worst event in modern history since the Holocaust, modern Jewish history tells us that, this is a reflex. It's a reflex of telling the Jews, sorry, guys, we're not going to accept this notion that you guys are weak and powerless, and we're supposed to now treat you like we treat African Americans or trans or the powerless or the poor and all that. Sorry. And also the fact that the war had started and they had, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 Gazans had died in the war, regardless of how we explain it. Most of them, were being used as human shields by Hamas. All that got used against us. And it became a horrible, very difficult situation because we got trapped. So many of us felt like, well, if I defend Israel, it's going to look like I don't care about 10,000 Palestinian children that got lost in the war. But something has happened in the last couple of months that has brought us back to the beginning, which is the war was over. There's a ceasefire. And then what we're seeing is the same hatred that we saw on college campuses when there was the war and thousands of Palestinians were dying is now showing up on college campuses, even though there are no Palestinians dying. And it's so obvious that there's hypocrisy because, these demonstrators never complained about the murder of Palestinians in Lebanon or Syria or Jordan. By the hundreds of thousands, Palestinians have lived in misery in Lebanon and Jordan, in refugee camps. We never ever hear about them. The only time we hear about poor Palestinians is when the Jews are involved, is when Israel is involved. The hypocrisy is kind of well established. When I hear all these facts, you know what it makes me feel like? It makes me feel like I'm winning. I'm winning. They're the hypocrites, they're the haters, and they're the liars. Instead of just complaining about that, I need to just use that to give me a stronger sense of self-esteem. I know it's painful to imagine that we could be hated now after October 7th, but instead of doing that, I look at Israelis. Have you been to Israel? I'm sure you've been to Israel in the last year and a half.
I was there twice last year and I'm going back in August. Yeah.
Amazing. I've been there three, four times. It's extraordinary how much it helps me when I see Israelis.
Yeah.
Israelis. I went to a wedding. I mean, I don't know, is it like last June, July? And the groom just came from the war and
Yeah.
his unit was there. I've never seen such joy in my life. And I realized that there is a different way of fighting in Israel, because they don't have this luxury of thinking about PR, the luxury of thinking about what's our image and how's the world gonna like us and all that. But because their war is so existential, they just worry about reality. And we have so much to learn from them.
I've actually always argued, David, that one of the reasons why, despite the circumstance and the dangerous neighborhood, as we call it, and everything that surrounds Israel, that year after year, when it comes down to the annual happiness index, Israel is always top of the list. And the reason is, when you're an Israeli, you have to do what we in the West, particularly in, like, say, the yoga world, or sort of the Enlightenment world, how we always say, live each day as if it were your last. And in Israel, that's reality. And they,
Yes.
like, every moment, it's like, suck the juice out of this moment. And that, I think, is why joy and happiness are so pervasive, even in the darkest of times in Israel.
Right, but there's another word. There's a third word that we've seen since October 7th, and that's the most important word, victory. A sense they must be seen as winners, or they will never ever survive. And I think we have something to learn from that. That even here in America, the Jews have a real advantage being seen as winners. We're victorious. When we get into a fight, we win. There's something so powerful about that. Not just because, well, you don't mess with the Jews and blah, blah, blah. Not just because of that. Because it's just a better look for us. And it's also a more accurate look. It's a better look for us. It's a better look for America, you know, and it's a better look for the Jews that we're teaching in the schools. It's just an overall better look. And we can learn that from the Israelis that if you notice since October 7th, the trauma of October 7th is Israel became a loser overnight. Overnight. They lost all their deterrence. It was a stunning humiliation of this great, supposedly the biggest, strongest army in the Middle East, got caught napping. And it was so embarrassing that since then, they've had to come back to regain their image of people you don't mess with, of being victorious. And that's something that's it's in the bloodstream of all Israelis. If our enemies don't see us as winners, we're done. We're done, right? It's obviously not as critical here in America, but there
Right.
is something we need to kind of learn from that, that at the end of the day, it's so much better for our thing if we manifest this idea that, yes, we may be hated, but we're not losers.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I literally just before we got on was watching the new entry for the Eurovision Song Contest. I'm not sure if you saw the video yet. It's so remarkable because I think that the thing that stood out for me the most was when she has groups of people who are like frolicking, there's not another word, like through the fields, particularly through the fields, through the ocean, and just in that quintessentially joyous Israeli manner. But for anybody who's been paying attention, in my mind, what I'm seeing is them running through the field because Hamas is chasing them. And you can't miss that if you are on this side of this. But this is and always has, I don't, it always has been really since the founding of Israel has been the narrative. Like we rise above. So David, I would like to argue that we, in talking about the reality of anti-Semitism, are not trying to win this race to the bottom of victimhood, but are pointing out some very real and painful realities of our existence. Now I want to circle back, because I know we're running out of time, to the white privilege thing, because this is very, very important right now, as you have mentioned more than once. So I want to put aside for a moment the fact that Jewish white privilege is a myth unto itself. Okay, the privilege indicates that you've been given something, not that you have worked your butt off, your tuchus off for it. So the solution, honestly, is not extracting ourselves from the white privilege narrative. It's actually extracting the white privilege narrative from society. And the reason that our history of persecution is important to reiterate to the world is because, first of all, history is doomed to repeat itself if we fail to learn its lessons. And even if we do learn its lessons, it keeps repeating itself. And the second thing is that in this like very deeply flawed and socially detrimental oppressor dichotomy, our history proves the ludicrousness of branding us as one or the other, as the oppressed or the oppressor. But in this day and age, as long as the narrative persists, the oppressed win by default. Right now, that's just like if you aren't in so-called oppressed class, you can do no wrong. And so that's the corner you want to be in. And everybody becomes these vast I think that Melanie Phillips just called it the oh no, it wasn't Melanie. It was Godsad, the suicidal apologist, right? Of just, oh no, we're not successful. Oh no, we're not great. Oh no, we're not wealthy. Oh, like trying to disprove our own success. So do you think that there is merit or maybe effectiveness in shining as an example of the potential to rise above the ashes, to use our history not as a race to the bottom of the victim pool, but rather as inspiration for other groups who resent our success instead to aspire to it.
There is a great way to do that, Shauna, and it's a column I have not written yet, and I'll just share it with you now, that every Holocaust museum in America is missing the most important thing. Chapter two. We have spent 80 years only on chapter one. We have invested hundreds of millions of dollars on conveying the horror of the Holocaust and the 6 million dead, one way or another, in pretty much every great city in America. And the most important part of the Holocaust, when it comes to Holocaust education, is what you just alluded to, chapter two, how we reacted in this great country of America. And I think 50% of any Holocaust museum should be on the disaster. And the other 50% should be on the Jewish reaction in America. That's how you do what you're talking about. So if you want to have people win the PR battles of being oppressed, let them win those battles. The battle I want to win is that Jews, we're here to help America, right? This is what we do. You want to wallow in victimhood and being oppressed? We're not going to try to fight you on that. But what we do is we're just here trying to contribute and continue this chapter two of really helping our great country that took us in.
I'm curious, David, have you ever had this conversation with, say, Michael Barenbaum or any of you?
You
Okay.
know what's crazy, Shauna? I'm not going to lie to you. I haven't.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't. I haven't. It's a recent thought, the chapter two. I started writing the column. I mean, I've had it in one way or another. I've had, I don't know, hundreds of conversations, just like you, on the Holocaust and stuff. I've said it, but this idea of, like, incorporating the chapter two in every Holocaust museum, that's something I've been starting to write recently that I haven't yet published. And I kind of feel pretty strongly about it. It's consistent with the theme of our podcast today, which is this broad definition of victory. That in Israel, there's a broad definition of victory, which is we got to win on the military front, but we also got to win in our weddings, in how we dance, and this joy in the European Song Festival. That's also part of the Israeli definition of victory, is this amazing song, this amazing joy, this broad definition. And I'd like to encourage American Jews to, adopt this broader definition of victory that I think will be good for us and for the country.
I think so too. David, I could talk forever. I know in jest, I recommended a 24-hour conversation. And I thought you might go for it, but before we spoke, you said probably an hour 15, which is just about now. So between an hour and 15 and 24, is it time to jump off?
Yeah, with 5 minutes.
Okay. So
Let's wrap it up.
let's finish this off, taking all your expertise into one ball of wax. From an advertising perspective and a journalist perspective, the product of an awareness campaign, right, is the awareness itself, not the subject of the campaign. Like, for example, Smokey Bear makes us aware of forest fires, so we won't set them. He's not selling forest fires. So, if you had to make an ad campaign today to promote, say, shared Jewish American values or just the positive Jewish experience, what would that look like? How would it be executed? Would it be grassroots, social media, political, diplomatic, NGO? Today there are just so many messages as we are all trying to unravel this very stubborn knot. So how do we unify this into one voice and one positive and effective message?
You know what's so funny, Shauna, is when I had my ad business, and if you were a client coming in and you represented, Judaism or Jews, whatever, we would say sure, and we'd come back to you in like 6 or 7 weeks.
Right.
We would do research for a couple of weeks. Oh my God. And it might be like months and months before we would even show ideas. But in the spirit of your great podcast and, putting me completely on the spot to have to think of something to say, there's one thought that I've always had about Judaism and Jews and so forth. It's good for you. Yeah, I heard it once. It's my beloved former partner, Rob Eshman. He wrote a column once. He had I see he was spending 2 days at some conference, and it was so much stuff and stuff and stuff. And then at the end, he said, "Ah, Judaism, it's good for you." In his classic him, a way of distilling everything. And I've never forgotten that, ever. So whenever I talk to kids, Judaism, it's good for you. And Jews, we're good for you. The truth is, Jews, we're good for America. Yeah. I don't
Wanted to,
know where it's going to go. But if you need something like instantly, right away, at least it's an attitude. And
sure.
we need to incorporate this attitude that we're not victims. We have so much goodness in us. It's a goodness that's in the cumulative wisdom of centuries that is in now with us. And it's an opportunity for us to return that wisdom. And I fear that in our zeal to fight the disease of anti-Semitism, that wisdom is going to shrink, and it's going to shrink the Jewish brand. And we just have to keep in mind the bigger picture of the Jewish brand as we go forward.
Yeah, I have to say that slogan evokes memories of when I grew up, one of the most effective campaigns ever, Milk It Does a Body Good, which revolutionized the advertising world. It may just be a winning campaign. I guess the unrolling strategy is gonna be,
Yeah. And it started on your podcast.
it started right here, folks. David, what a pleasure it's been to reconnect. I have treasured having you as a friend for 25 years now. When I was that client who came into Suisse & Miller asking how you could sell our brand. And it's been amazing to watch your transformation from ad man to advocate, and I have just been in such awe. And though I haven't had the opportunity to be in your presence very much lately, I think the last time was at the Beverly Hills rally was the last time I saw you in 2023, perhaps. Every time, every week when I see and pick up the Jewish Journal at synagogue, my heart smiles and I'm like, that's my David.
Great.
Is there anything else that you want to add, David, before we sign off?
I'm good. I'm good. This was great. This was good for me.
Well, thank you so much. It was good for me, and I think it's good for the Jews. So, thank you again, and it's been an absolute pleasure.
Likewise. Likewise.
Am Yisrael Chai.